Hello and welcome to the very first in a special two-part bonus series of Community here at the end of LGBTQ History Month in partnership with Samsung. I'm Alexis Court, and these two bonus episodes that you're about to hear, they're all about tackling homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, all of the queer phobias in sport. They were recorded at the Samsung KX Space in King's Cross as part of their collab event series. We hosted two events. One, an in-depth interview with out rugby player Keegan Hurst on toxic masculinity, gay men's mental health, femphobia, and homophobia in sports. You'll hear that in part two of the special. But in this, our first episode, I sat down with Matt Lister, the medal-winning slalom canoer, Ben Hunt, the BBC's first LGBT correspondent, and deep, deep, deep friend of the podcast, Kachenga, writer, poet, and trans activist.
Hi, oh my God. Imagine seeing you all here. This is the first time we're all seeing each other this evening. How wonderful. So, we're here to talk about LGBTQ inclusion in sport. We know that as a society, we are losing connections. We are losing spaces for people to connect with those around them. We know that our physical health is deteriorating. We know that our mental health is in a real state in so much of the world. And there is one thing, there are many things, but there is one thing in particular that really has the opportunity and the potential to be a great solution to this, and that is sports. But yet, why do so many LGBTQ people from all across the spectrum feel like they're not welcome in this space? Why do they feel excluded from this world? Especially when it has so much to offer us. So that is what we're going to be chatting about this evening with my wonderful guests. So Matt, you were a professional athlete. You were competing at high level. Tell us about your journey to that. How did that come about?
So I fell into canoeing when I was around six. My sister had gone to an Outward Bound course with Brownies, and she tried it, and I got jealous that she was doing something I wasn't doing, so I demanded that I went along as well. And for the first 3 years, I kind of messed around in the pool sessions to the point that the staff told me that if I didn't do something productive with it, that I couldn't come back. So they put me into a grassroots scheme called Paddle Power, where you tried lots of different disciplines of canoeing, and it was slalom that I fell into because I started to win medals, and I was like, oh, this one's fun, I like this one. Slalom stuck for me, and that's how I got into the ladder of it, and then continued on through junior for Great Britain, won bronze, under 23s, I won silver, and then as a senior, I won gold at the World Championships for the team.
Very nice. And Ben, you played sport in school, I believe, as well.
Things were very good for a while, until the day that I was outed, and I actually had to leave the school. What I found was that I went from a position of being a captain on various different sports teams to almost being pushed into the stereotypical gay male, which I had no idea what that even meant. But suddenly, I was looked at weirdly in changing rooms. Suddenly, I felt that, was I actually looking at people in changing rooms? Because they felt like I was looking at them, but was I actually looking at them? So by double-checking myself on it, I didn't really want to be there. So I found that my relationship with sport went to a really poisonous place where I just felt like I wasn't welcome anymore. And even if I look at the situation now, it's weird because we could be in exactly the same position. I guess I still, if it was happening today, I probably still would have felt that way because I haven't really seen much progress within the sporting world. So that was my relationship with sport. It's in a much better place now, though. Much better place. But back in the day, it was horrible. Really, really bad.
Kachenga, how about you?
You and I are, like, we disproved my dad's theory that rugby would, sort us out and put us on the straight and narrow. Because when I was being bullied in secondary school, this was before my medical transition and stuff, and so he compelled me to join the team and stuff, and all he ended up doing was defining my type, and things were like really rough, and I ended up just like retreating into myself and isolating and, yeah, being the, just coming up with as many excuses to avoid PE as possible, which made me a really voracious reader. And then over the years, the message I got was just that if I wanted to take my transition seriously, just give up. Just give up on the sports. It's not for you, you know. And so I did. And for my self-care and, you know, just I've always just gone to spaces where I'm actively welcomed. And because of the conversation around trans people in sport, I just didn't find anywhere where I felt comfortable until I started to meet feminists who found, in their inclusivity, encouraged me to bring health and fitness into my life in ways that made sense for me. So that was, yeah, mainly through dance and yoga and, yeah, just talking about spirituality and also finding women who I can speak about, you know, my eating disorders and, you know, that sort of thing. So having like a broad, holistic conversation about who you are coming into a space has been really helpful for me.
Nice. So similarly to Ben and Kachenga, I played sports and I was connected with it. And then I also got outed and that whole world of something that I enjoyed got taken away. And as well as being kind of rejected by teammates, I also did the, well, screw you, you don't want me, I don't want you even more. And I only from then on did solo individual sports, never any team sports. I would go quite happily go and do all of the long distance running to get away from everyone. But Matt, that is not your experience. No. You had a really positive experience from as a teenager into going out and actually competing as an out athlete. What was that process like for you and why do you think it was different?
I think for me it was, I hated PE at school. I was never good at ball sports. I had two left hands and three left feet. It didn't work for me. And it was something where I found a sport I was starting to be good at. Again, like there was the hideous bullying being like the same. You had the locker room chat with the kids in school. Yes. There was a happy slapping craze when I was a kid. And
that was the worst.
The worst.
It didn't even make sense.
Always. It's like no one is getting happy from being slapped in the back of the head. I was called every name under the sun, and that was the kind of thing that was pushing me away from sport. And then when, again, I came to canoeing, it was an escape for me. I was a very creative kid. I liked doing those things. And once those, like, the results started to come in, I think you earn the respect of your peers, and when you're in elite sport, it really doesn't matter who you are, as long as you are producing something, as in, like, between you and your peers, you're producing something that is a decent result. People are going to, like, their heads are going to prick up, and they're going to see you for what you stand for and your merits, as opposed to, like, the background chatter. No one really cares about it. Yeah.
You mentioned being embraced by your straight ally teammates.
Yeah.
So in a way, it must have impacted somehow if you actually felt an embrace rather than just a, meh, something doesn't matter. What was that?
I think because we go to the after parties from every competition, and I would always feel like, the same as growing up, all your friends are having their first kiss, their first boyfriend or girlfriend, and you feel like you have to protect yourself from all that because you're trying to hide who you are. When I came out to my teammates, I told one of my best friends at the time, he was my teammate, and it was the same response I'd had from most of my family. It was like, yeah, we kind of knew. You didn't really hide it very well. So it was one of those things that, like, I decided I was not going to come out until my 18th birthday when I knew most of school was going to be passed. I didn't have that extra pressure on me that was going to detract from my sport and how I could focus on sport. And on my 18th birthday, I then started to tell my teammates, and we ended up all going out to the gay bars in Leeds and having a really good night. I think the only weird bit of that evening was, as most LGBT people do, they build this coming out process up in their head to this enormous thing, and you realize that the people around you love you for the person you are and not because of what you are or these little bits about you. And the person I was most worried about coming out to was my canoeing partner, because I did doubles. and we were basically married. We would travel the world together. We would stay in rooms together. We would literally, you'd sleep together all the time. And you would think, like, if I tell this person who is my world, because we compete together, we are in the same boat together, if I tell him and he disowns me, my career that I've just spent all these years building is going to come crumbling down right in front of my eyes. And he is from rural Wales. He is he is as farmer as they come, but he is, to this day, one of my closest friends. He just took it so well. Again, we know, Matt, it's no surprise. I love you for who you are, and nothing is going to change that just because of the people that you fall in love with or the people you find attractive. It just means nothing.
And how did you find the response from governing bodies and coaches and people with power in the world of sport?
Here's the real tea. This is it. Here we go.
There was a bit of friction between me and one of the coaching staff, and to the point where my parents intervened when, at the beginning of the training year, we were divided up into new teams, and my parents intervened and said, we outright don't want our son with this man because he's made it very clear that he doesn't hold him on the same standard as he holds all the other kids. But that was the only issue I really had within sport. I think in my sport, it wasn't so much the face fits, it was the results are as black and white as they can be. You are the fastest from the top of the course to the bottom of the course without hitting any gates. You can't really, it's not like a team sport where like, oh, you guys play together kind of okay. It's like, no, it's like, it's black, yeah. Very clear cut.
Very clear cut. So actually that performance allowed you to kind of bypass it and overcome that. Which is interesting. The reason why we ask is because, as Ben touched on earlier, we are seeing a lot of the organizations who have power in the world of sports, these gatekeeping organizations, not being very good trans allies. And we know that a lot of the football leagues, a lot of the rugby union organizers, and even the IOC, they're saying, yes, it's great, we'll change our logos for Pride. But then Team GB, in fact, have just done this within the last couple of days for the Rainbow Laces campaign. They changed their logo online to Team LGBT. But within the last year, they have been not very good allies for trans athletes, and they have been very vocal in their support of women, cisgendered women athletes, who have complained about the inclusion of trans women in sports. Kachenga, how do you think that trickles down to grassroots trans inclusion in sport?
It just leaves us out. You know, there's no need to pretend that things aren't getting a lot worse. I was listening to a podcast, Marsha's Plate, and they invited Monica Roberts, who's a great trans activist from Houston, Texas, and has a blog called Transgrio, which, it's just really fun. It's such an important source resource in our community. And she was speaking about Renee Richards, who's a trans tennis player who, you know, transitioned as an adult and had a great time and wrote an autobiography. And, you know, a lot of that has been, all of the history of trans people in sport has really been invisibilized by the current discourse. So the fact that we've always been here and always been taken part has, been submerged under these stories about how nefarious we are and how dominant we're going to be and everything. And, you know, transness, queerness, you know, sexuality, gender, it's all on a spectrum. So it's hard for me to hear the hate directed at Casa Semenya, for example, because even though we're coming from, you know, assigned different genders at birth, and we're coming from really different places, like, it's you having your body discussed so broadly is just really dehumanizing. And for me, it made me just want to run away just to protect myself. And so I think we're just going to see a lot more of that. And I worry about a generation of people who are just not going to experience public life in the way that they deserve.
Understandable. Ben, as someone who has covered some of these topics,
yes,
what have you seen the change in the conversation being?
I would say, on that point, Kachenga, I think that the younger generations are a lot more woke when it comes to gender and identity than older generations are. If you look at the debate when it comes to especially trans inclusion in sport, you do see that most people agree with the fact that there should be almost two camps. There should be a male aspect and a female aspect. The problem then becomes how you then define who should be sat within those areas. And I think that's where the debate is at the moment. But what you're seeing with younger generations is they really don't care about that. They're living their best lives, identifying however they want to identify. So I think that what you're really going to see over the next few years is this generational divide and this gap almost increase to the point where young people are just jumping into the sports that they want to and defining themselves how they need to. And older people who maybe are looking down and just being like, well, you should actually be that. So how can we make you that? What terms can we use for you to put you into that camp? So I think there is a little bit of positive within that. But that being said, it has been a real challenge covering these issues. And I've only been in this role for the past, what, like 6-7 months. But within that time, it has been very poisonous. Very poisonous. Especially when you're seeing cisgender female athletes who were so celebrated by certain generations. I won't name any names because I'm impartial as a BBC journalist. But you are seeing a lot of people who some people may be held up as their heroines, for instance, when they were coming to terms with being a lesbian in their younger years. And now this person's coming out and saying that they're not supportive of trans people and that we should be looking at hormone bases and blah, 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 blah. And as a result, there's almost a bit of a conflict of interest where they're like, this is my heroine, they're hating trans people, so should I also hate on trans people too? And that then trickles down to us, because to cover these things, if you have a very prominent athlete saying these things, then you have to almost use their voices. So I'm now seeing a real divide within newsrooms where you're seeing some of my female editors, for instance, who are like, you need to include this voice of this incredible female athlete that is one of my heroines. And then I'm just like, well, actually, no, because she's not representative. Total side note as well, there's reviews that say around 1% of the population is trans. And in all of the coverage that I've done, I found it fascinating that there is such a debate, because actually when you look at it, how many trans athletes can you name that are actually elite athletes? The fact that this huge debate has taken place and people seem so worried about their various different sports, and it's just like, boo, well, are you really under threat? I don't know.
I think, yeah, it is encouraging. What you've outlined is encouraging. Nevertheless, I think that it's an issue of like power and dominance. And so irrespective of, you know, whatever's occurring in younger generations, those who are in power in newsrooms, those who are editors, coaches, etc., that it's that which is in those locations of power where the most difference will be made. And so, unfortunately, I think my current bleak outlook is, you know, very much conditioned by my Twitter timeline. But I really want to be there with you and like and hope. But I get the messages in my inbox from trans people whose mental health is suffering, you know, from those who are not just leaving sports, not just taking part in space, but, you know, the issues of self-harm and dysfunction. These conversations are not just stopping people from taking part in a game and taking part in sport, but they're also leading to people not taking part in life.
Yeah, and you do see that. I mean, as I say, the coverage that I've done over the past few months has kind of reflected that, to the point that it's been very depressing, even reading through my email inbox and seeing some of the pictures that I get. Because it's, aside from our fabulous rainbow glittery pride months, away from that, it is dark, it is depressing, it is suicide, it is all kind of triggers. It's horrible. It's really, really bad. But that being said, I mean, I just think there's so much power in positivity. I really do. And I don't scroll through social media, and some people have dragged me for that, because I genuinely do find that it's just a very poisonous place. But within that, I will happily just post photos of myself and my partner and my new puppy, because for me, it's the idea that, look, when I was growing up, I didn't see that kind of positive representation, and that's what I ultimately needed to help me through it. So yes, I can understand why people engage in Twitter fights and all of that, but I'm over here just trying to sprinkle some glitter button some positivity on it, because otherwise it can be too much. It really, really can. If we do focus on the negative, then goodness, I probably wouldn't even leave my house in the morning, because it would just be telling us that you're not a human, you don't deserve to be here and all of that. But yeah, those views obviously do exist.
Yeah, and unfortunately that is the way that a lot of our media is vilifying and portraying trans people at the moment. So how do we, as people who are involved in sports at a grassroots level, how do we try and combat that? Matt, Kachenga, Ben, big question.
I did a I worked with Tanny Gray Thompson on an athlete duty of care. She was doing an athlete duty of care document, and I contributed to that. I did a bit of research with the few LGBT athletes that I knew, and added a little page for LGBT athlete duty of care. Which hopefully, I mean, I've been very distanced from it since, because it was during a time where I'd just finished sport and couldn't really be around it too much because of my own mental health. I feel like that's something that we need to do more of. It needs to be fed into not just the grassroots level, but it needs to hit the elite levels first and trickle down. So as soon as you get these world-class athletes understanding the way that the rest of the world works, not just within their own little bubbles, then the faster it can then trickle down to everyone else.
Do you think it has to be trickle down? You don't think we can build from grassroots up? Because many political and social movements have been built at grassroots and up.
If you start at grassroots, it inevitably will go up through the generations. I think quickest and fastest hitting is you raise the voices from the top, and they get the most audience. They get the audience quicker. But obviously, I agree, both ends.
Kachenga, as the person who is living in this experience, who is having people reach out to them, what do you think is the support that they need from people in the room?
Sorry, ask that again. What's the support they need?
From people in the room, people listening, who are there actively taking part as members of our community, trying to be still active in the world of sport. How do we be better allies?
I mean, I cannot help you be a better ally, babes. I mean, that's a Google question. I think for me, like just reflecting on my own experience, because I was taking part in feminist conversations, I was able to identify who cared and who liked about me, and it was on them. They reached out to me. You know, I feel really fortunate. I don't have any macro arguments as to how, you know, you can improve the lot of, you know, trans and queer people in sport. But when I think about those who, you know, reached out to me personally and said, "We want you to be a part of our space," it was because of their political education, I guess. But I think they just had a really solid understanding of what it was like to be marginalized themselves. So yeah, you just have to have a broader understanding of what solidarity means. And by being inclusive, you improve the space for everyone. I feel like what I benefited from was a wider concerted decision by whatever group I was taking part that where the women just felt that they wanted to create a space that was inclusive of everyone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I can transpose that into the world of sports, it would be those of us who are in clubs or who go to gyms or who practice solo sports and work with coaches. Mm. It's about us thinking, actually, maybe or maybe we didn't have great experiences in school, but we continued because of the privilege that our status as cisgender people afforded us. Yes, maybe we had those stairs and those double stairs in the changing room, but actually no one was analysing our bodies and debating our bodies quite so publicly. So now that we are safe, we can't just be like, oh, this is great, I've got my gay football team. We have to go and be like, ah, there are people missing from our family here. Mm-hmm. Bring them in. Mm-hmm. Would that be right?
That's correct, yeah. The onus is on the privilege to reach out to the marginalised, for sure.
Ben, how do you see this working?
I think that's a really fascinating point, because if there's one thing I've seen over the past few months in this role, it's that the idea of this homogenous group called the LGBT community, I find fascinating, because I'm like, where is it? Who is it? Who is part of it? I think from now, I kind of see it as an LGBT bubble where there's lots of separate communities underneath it, because I get pitches all the time from cis, white, gay men telling me various different things about their views around trans people, whether it was an interview that I did with Monroe Bergdorf, whether it was something that I did around transphobic hate crimes, in which someone was just like, yeah, but it's really bad for us too in the North, and we're gay men, and blah, 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 blah. It's just like, yeah, I know, I'm going to come to you, but for the moment, let's just focus on this. It's fascinating that there isn't more solidarity within this community. And I think to even drill down deep to look at it within a sports perspective, I mean, you're going through several different layers of other things that need to be dealt with first. But, yeah, I think it's an interesting one. There's so much that I think needs to change. It's the idea... Oh, I had an interesting email yesterday. Someone said that I was wrong for using the term allies, because allies implies that we're at war. And actually, we shouldn't be at war. It's too much of a negative. I was like, I definitely didn't come up with the term allies in my piece. But anyway, but they said we should actually be using the term accomplice. So they emailed, they full-on emailed my BBC editor to be like, just so you know, your LGBT specialist is using terms I find really divisive for the community. To the point that my straight editor's looking at that just like, you really don't have your stuff together. I do have it together, but there's so many fractures within this community that now we're almost pulling down each other. And maybe, I don't know what it's going to take, but there needs to be something that kind of like combines and unifies the bubble. I think it definitely happens during Pride Month. You may disagree with this, but I think I definitely see it within June and July when everyone's kind of together. But then after that, yeah, it's actually quite sour. It's quite poisonous. So I don't know. I'm not sure whether or not the community is there as a whole to support trans people in the way they need to be supported within sports. I have no idea.
I think my view on that would be that, and I completely share the opinion that actually as a collective community, the LGBTQ plus spectrum is A, growing, B, diversifying, and splintering into different groups. Now, when you look at whether that is a good or a bad thing, there are many different ways that you can go off. But if we look at an issue like sport, I do think we know that there is a place where queer people need, for want of a better, less stigmatized word, safe spaces, places where you can just go and just, you know, you're going to be accepted and embraced. Now, another reason why I think that is important is because they can cut across each of the letters of the spectrum, and they can hopefully rebuild some of those bridges. And so whether you or we are trying to connect with somebody, because if you're trying to form an artificial relationship with someone, like, hey, you're a trans person, you're a lesbian, and I'm a gay, let's all be great friends. Oh, we've got nothing in common. Oh.
Yes.
But if you can build a great relationship through a shared interest and build something together, that's something that I think the world of sport can really do to help unify us, as long as everyone's interested in it, whether that is table tennis, whether that's doing yoga together, whether that's rugby or ping pong or canoeing. That's something where I think that we actually need to do more work on making sure that our inclusive clubs are...
And I think also diverse in terms of locations. I had a really interesting message from someone who was just like, well, it's all well and good if you can join LGBT sports in London, Manchester or Birmingham, but what about the rest of us? I was like, ooh, gosh. Because I don't know. I don't know if there are actually these different clubs outside of very metropolitan and very LGBT-friendly bubbles. You could probably tell me. But at the moment, when I was looking, I was like, well, there really aren't that many in like the actual hearty regions. And I guess that's where they're needed most.
I mean, I can say there are 30, yes, that is correct, 30 gay and inclusive rugby clubs in Britain.
Woohoo!
But and again, and I apologise, I wish that Char was here because she could give a great view on this, because Char does live out in one of those places and she is a lesbian. So it would be great to have that view on that as well. But what we do know is that actually these big organisations are trying to improve that. and push that message outside of our safe places in the hubs of the cities through campaigns, some of like Rainbow Laces, which is happening right now. Do we think that this is starting to move the conversation in a positive way? What are the views on that across the panel?
I think if you look at the Twitter feed of the gay footballer, I think it will show you that actually the level of conversation isn't quite there yet to really facilitate people to come out fully in public and speak about themselves and who they are. I was fascinated by the amount of coverage that this Twitter feed got. For those of you that don't know, there was a Twitter feed, a Twitter account, sorry, that was started. I think it was literally just called The Gay Footballer. And it was someone that said they were a championship footballer who was going to come out on a specific date. And UK media blew up trying to cover this person, robot, whatever it was, that started this Twitter feed. And I just kind of sat back and just observed at the time, because I'd only just started in the role. But I found it fascinating, the amount of negativity that was still there surrounding this, and the amount of hype that was there, because it got to a point where I was just like, even if this person is real, this is going to be the worst day of their lives to actually come forward and say who they are. Because the amount of hype that there was, it wasn't positive. It got to a point of spectacle. And I don't know who would want to come out with that level of pressure. I mean, I found it hard enough being outed to around like 50 people. But to put yourself forward on that international stage and actually say who you are and who you love, it brings me back to the point that not every single person is an activist. And I find it, I find it quite troubling that there is still this level of attention that could be put to something like that. I'm going to let you add to the conversation. I'm not. Yeah, yeah. What else are the other thoughts on that?
I think it's, you know, culturally, with regards to like gender and sexuality, that when you were talking about the gay footballer, it reminded me of Wendy Williams and her campaign on the radio to find the gay rapper. You know, I think there's an interesting parallel between sports and hip-hop culture in that they are seen as like the last bastions of masculine dominion. You know, we have the back pages of papers, and if we give in, then, you know, we're going to be, you know, herded up and, you know, live on a farm, and they'll just like farm us for our sperm. And, like, literally, that's what these feminists want. That's just, you know, that's like an incel fuel fantasy, as it goes. Short story coming out next week. But I really do feel like that fear is like maniacal, and to use one of their phrases, hysterical. You know, they are really scared of what it means to dilute masculinity, you know, with any sense of gender nonconformity. So whether that's behavioral or in terms of who you're attracted to or who you are, they feel that that's their territory. Like, if we give in to sport, then we're going to lose our grip on society in general. Anyway, so, yeah.
So, looking at that, and I completely agree that there is a whole view that so much of sport is this last bastion of, like, true, real masculinity and man's man stuff. But we have this whole conversation going on culturally as to, well, do we all want to have a new seat at the table, or do we want to have our own table around the corner in a much better place? So where do you stand on trying to infiltrate the world of, for want of a better phrase, exclusive heterosexual sport versus creating LGBTQ inclusive sports clubs?
Well, I would have done really well in canoeing, because I was the only one that I knew. I feel like it's something that it's, for me personally, I would like it to stay as one. I don't see what the benefit is going to be of being even further divided, being pushed apart, being almost ostracized or alienated because you are an LGBT person. I don't see how, in most cases, that comes into argument, where, like, just because I'm a gay man is not going to make me any better or worse of an athlete as you as a heterosexual man. yeah, that's my two pence on that. I don't see.
I think there's power in community. I think the point that you want to be part of a sport isn't to exclude yourself, it is to be included. And I think there's a lot of power in that. And just hearing your coming out experiences to your teammates, I was like, wow, that sounds wonderful. Good Lord. Yeah, really, it's nice. It's nice to hear that level of positivity. It really is. Because, like I said, so much of what LGBT media is, especially when it actually makes it to mainstream news media, and to me, is negative. It is the triggering stuff. It's the horrible things that someone's got beaten up, someone's been outed, it's always so negative. So yeah, there's real power in that positivity. I like that.
I think when people are trying to jump on a story as well, that's where it gets sour. There's the running, everyone always talks about Justin Fashanu, who sadly took his life 7 months after he came out within the world of football. And now everyone thinks that that is the precedent, that is what's going to happen, the reason that's why it happened to him. And you mean, where do you go from there?
Yeah, I feel like separatism has a bad rap. You know, it's like you can have both and, you know, 30 LGBT rugby clubs and, you know, rugby's still doing okay, right? Like, it's not terrible to have, you know, smaller communities that, you know, benefit those who take part, and yet you're still able to take part on a national stage. I find it hard to, like, get worked up about anyone who wants to form a grouping and do that. But I think because of my experiences, I just feel like I'm being torn in so many different directions. And so fighting for inclusivity on like a national and a macro stage is just something that I don't feel capable of or adequately prepared for. It just feels like it's out of my hands, like I can only look after myself.
You can only affect the immediate sphere around you rather than the big macro issues. So then, thank you for that segue, because that really neatly ties us into the final question before we hand over to the audience. What are the tangible things that we can all start doing to improve LGBT life in sport?
I'm going to let the sports man go first. Go.
I can only speak from my experiences, but what I do is I try and be as visible as possible. I try and be as authentically myself, as much as I hate that phrase. Being as much of myself. I'm a very effeminate man when I want to be. I'm a very masculine man when I want to be. I play all of the colors of the rainbow. Visibility is hands down the most important thing, because if you can't see someone that is in the same shoes as you want to be, you can't visualize yourself getting to that point.
I would definitely agree with that. I think it's all about visibility. It's about positive representation and whatever that means. It is, I think it's so important, like you say, you can't become something that you can't see. And until, well, I will take it back. When I was growing up and I was coming to the terms I was a black gay man, I remember trying to find some kind of role model to tell me that I could actually be a black gay man. There was a point that I was just like, I don't think I could actually be this, because there's no one else like this. Am I the only person? And then suddenly, Big Brother popped up, and a guy called Derek went on it. Do you remember Derek from Big Brother? He was this conservative guy who was fox hunting, living his best life with his fabulous British voice. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, it's me and Derek. Okay, so here we go. I could actually be a black gay man. So I'm going to become like a conservative. I'm going to wear tweed. I'm going to go fox hunting. I know. That's it. But at the time, without the internet, I was like, well, it's literally us. This is all that I can be, because there was nobody else. So yeah, I think in some ways you do need to have at least an inkling that you can be something in order to become that. So I think within sport, you definitely are seeing that. You're seeing people like yourself who have done incredible things in your career and then come out. You're seeing, whether it's been in rugby, whether it's been in football, people have done great things and then suddenly been like, oh, by the way, I am actually gay. And that is helping things. Before that, who was there? So I think things definitely are changing. I think positive representation is the way to go. And hopefully, I was also going to make a point as well around people that don't want to be representative. I think it is so important to remember that not everybody is an activist. And in Pride months, some of my friends made the point about some of my coverage. They were just like, well, to be honest, the more you do about LGBT things on the BBC, the more uncomfortable conversations are with my parents because they watch the 6 o'clock news, the 10 o'clock news, and as a result of it, they then think more about gay things and LGBT things and have these uncomfortable conversations when I go to theirs for dinner on Sunday evenings. And I was thinking, right, okay, fair dues. Like, you're not an activist, you don't want to speak out for the community. But I really do think that you have to be visible. You have to be. There has to be an element of actually having these conversations. Maybe not necessarily everybody is fighting on behalf of a community, but you have to at least be open to people's questions around what it means to be LGBT. Because if you shut out those conversations, then people feel awkward about coming to events like this, because then they don't actively feel like they can make mistakes in public. They feel like if they misgender someone, their career in corporate is going to be over. Things like that happen as a result of not answering questions. So I think you need to have an element of positive representation and people willing to stand on a platform being like, this is me, ask me all the questions you need, and let's go.
Mm-hmm. I think it's about making our support as vocal as possible. You know, for myself, like, you know, wading through the salacious pits in my DMs, like it's best when I'm able to find support from someone that I wasn't expecting and stuff. And I feel like there's a need to make sure that we're reaching out to those who we know are really going through it. And then, you know, if that's not a private message, if it's in public, you don't know who's going to be seeing that. You know, I'm sure that someone like Hester Semenya, for example, has been really boosted by not just, you know, the private messages that they receive, but seeing the support that she receives from various different sections, and that what that means for others who are going through that too.
And so we need to actually be more supportive when people are sticking their heads above the parapet, and we need to come for our own a lot less and make allowances for. And so that's actually the way that we can use our people power to get behind those of us who, yep, they might not be fully formed, they might not be the perfect activist or the perfect role model, but they're on a journey and we can help them get there. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so now some microphones are going to run into the audience. I'm afraid because of the technical issues, we are slightly behind on question time. But if anyone would like to stick their hand up for a question, we can go quickly.
Thank you. So the question's open to all of you guys, and thank you. Arguably one of the biggest sports in the world is football, and it doesn't have the best reputation in terms of inclusivity. How can we improve that? In the black community, we have things like Kick It Out and initiatives that kind of encourage anti-racism campaigns, but what can we do to get more LGBTQ inclusivity in football?
I think it's about engaging with the community that people are actually looking to represent. Like you said, there are so many of these various different football networks that are LGBT friendly, and I think it's actually about speaking to those communities, finding out, especially if there are very good players within those teams, finding out what necessarily prevented them from going higher. I think that's really important. Just speak actively to the communities you're trying to represent.
I think there's something in there about buying power as well. We know that football runs on money. It's got ludicrous amounts of financial backing behind it. And unfortunately, we know that, I won't name, but some of the organizations involved in it are pretty damn corrupt in where they accept money from. Now, we kind of let that pass. We don't get vocal enough. So we had an instance where there was a tournament which went to a couple of countries which have homophobic laws. And so people, just supporters, let alone the athletes, were excluded from that. I think we need to be far more vocal about that. And I think that we as a community, as individuals, we need to have conversations with the people around us and explain why it's an issue so that we can convert the people around us to being on side. And I think, sorry, Ben, I think we need to be put more pressure on people in the media to be like, hey, call this out, but do it nicely. Thank you.
First off, thank you. Do you feel like education needs to happen on kind of to coaches. So I'm a sports psych, but trans and racial issues never come up. And we have to deal with athletes every day dealing with issues from anxiety to anything under the sun. But we're not taught in master's level about transgender or multicultural issues that we might face. So do you think education needs to change in some way or the other?
I mean, I'll jump in 100%. I completely agree that education does need to change. We know that in September, SRE, sex and relationship education, is coming into schools, mandatory from September. Hopefully, that will then continue to trickle up, because if they are forcibly being taught this in schools from a younger age, actually, if there's this then gap, when they get to doing it to A level or to university level, it will become more and more obvious. So I think you're absolutely right. Our education has to be in part of it. How do we, as people, as the person, sorry to turn this back on you, but as the person who is there doing this as an educator, how do we support you in that goal? Can we give her the mic back?
This.
Okay. Sorry. Be part of the solution. Join us.
I'm going to try and do something. I think education is important, but also understanding the issues that you guys go through, because we're not taught a lot in sports psych. We're taught how to deal with the main things like building resilience and self-talk, but what are the issues that people face? And what's excluding them from doing sport? Because, Billy brought me here today, but I never even thought that this was an issue. I know it sounds stupid, but I never thought that this was an issue. I don't have any transgender clients. I don't have any gay clients that I know of, or lesbian clients. So I don't ever have to deal with them issues, but it doesn't mean that it's not a problem. So I think workshops with stuff like the BPS, which is my society, workshops in schools, going in to do talks at master's level, because it's things that we're going to deal with. And if we don't know how to deal with it and how to help people, we're going to advise them wrong. We're going to give them the wrong solution. So I think going into societies like the BPS, going into universities, setting up stands, pushing it, tweet about it, and just making sure that, because as Ben said, us at a younger level, we don't care. Sprinkle glitter on everything. So educate us and it will just go up. But I think you need to work top down and bottom up at the same time to make sure that it's effective, is my opinion. I hope I slayed that.
Did you want to add a point?
I was just going to say, previous two questions have brought to mind that just the need for us to have a historical understanding of what led us to this point. When, you know, if you're in an educational scenario, I feel that you should be inspired by decolonizing the curriculum, sorry, that alliteration there, movement. And so, you know, decolonizing the curriculum actually came out of, you know, decolonizing the mind, like Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. And it's a really thin book, but it's just so powerful. And I think if we have that understanding, I feel then that will impact the way you work. You know, like, we turn certain things into buzzwords, and I feel like that cheapens them. Like, intersectionality is not just like a word to put on a bag. It's a way that you change your understanding of political analysis, and you understand how someone's converging identities can lead to specific experiences. And so I think, like, if you have that concern and understanding of, like, where you are from a political perspective and what your subject position is, and, you know, whether you are the right person to bring something up or not, you know, that all of those things are going to impact the how successful you are moving forward. And also, you know, I feel like the answer to the previous gentleman was in the question. You know, we have a history of anti-racist organizing, and as a result, you have a model of resistance. I feel like everything that had occurred in the Let's Kick Racing About Football movement can be mirrored without, you know, insulting those who've come before. There's nothing wrong with feeding off of each other politically. And when we have done, we've caused incredible change. You know, like, it's not... it's not coincidental that, you know, Stonewall is occurring around the time of, you know, a new wave of feminism, you know, and all the, as well as, you know, off the back of civil rights. Like, I feel that we can, you know, put our finger out and, like, listen to the energy and, like, just, and try to feed off of each other. Because of our marginality and how few of us there are, people may think that because we are anywhere between 0.7 and 1.2% of the population, that trans issues have nothing to do with all of you. Of course they do. Do you know what I mean? You need to be free to not just express yourself, but, you know, even, like, the way your bodies are, you know, thinking about the way that black bodies have been racialized historically. Like, if you really feel that cutting someone like myself out of sport means that you are going to be safe, like, no, like, these notions of race and gender, they are constructs, they mutate and stuff. So just like the oppressor mutates, like, the victim mutates too. Like, it will be you next. Trust.
And just a little bit, sorry, just quick on the back of that, the work that I did with my sports psych, the biggest gains I made with her was I went from one sports psych to another, and the first one was very technical and went into, like, very much teaching me as an athlete, whereas the next one I worked with, who I worked with for the rest of my career, she taught me as a human being and understood that an athlete is not just an athlete. They are an athlete within these constructs of, like, these times of training, but then they go home and they have a life outside of that. They have relationships, they have, like, families. So it's just remembering these people are people. They're not just machines that do the work.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that really interesting question. And also, thank you for coming along and starting to do that work for as well. A brilliant round of applause to my panelists, please.
This was a talk recorded at Samsung KX, part of the CoLab event series, and presented in partnership with Samsung. Don't forget, the second bonus episode is an in-depth one-on-one chat with Keegan Hurst. Thanks for listening to this bonus episode. The wait for season 2 of Community isn't long now. See you soon then. Bye, my loves.